just lovely. So ready for us to all be back here in this space together and to sing and to share worship together, and not this day. I've been saying all year that we are headed for the most divisive election season in our lifetimes. And now this week we know who are going to be on the tickets on both parties, and it's clear that that's coming true. So we've been preparing since February for this. Do you remember back in February when we started studying forgiveness stories together to build in ourselves a capacity to step back so that we can act and not react, so that we can work out of the center of God's love and not be blown hither and yon by what's going on in the world around us? I want to add a data point. There's a thing called the fallacy of false equivalence, and the idea is that if two positions are at odds, that they're probably equally off from the truth. And so the truth is at the halfway point between those, and you're trying to balance those competing positions. And this series on the Beatitudes we're calling Balance for an Unsteady Time. And there is, in fact, within some of the Beatitudes that need to balance. We heard that last week. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for dikaiosune, which means both righteousness and justice. And we have to learn how to balance those two things. When is it the thing that I'm supposed to do right, and when does it call me out into the world? This week is not like that. This week, the word that Jesus offers is simple, and simply at odds with the way the world works. And so when that happens, what we're supposed to know is Jesus hasn't missed the mark. We're not supposed to find some place that's halfway between where Jesus is and how the world operates and find a way to balance between those. Jesus gives us a pretty stark choice this week. Once you've heard the word, then you have a choice to either reject what Jesus says as Pollyanna, or to reject the politics of hate as ungodly. But don't try to balance the two. And don't try to find a point halfway between the two. Don't even try. The word for us this week is in Matthew chapter 5, verse 7. And there Jesus said simply, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall be shown mercy." Friday night, the Astros came out of their slump and they beat the Mariners 11-1. You know, in Little League, if you're up by 10 runs after 4.5 innings, they just call the game. They call that the mercy rule. And growing up, we played this game where we'd interlock our hands together and you'd try and get somebody else in a position, and you kept pushing until they cried out, "Mercy!" And in both of those cases, mercy seems to be, I'm inflicting punishment on someone else, and I'm going to choose to stop. Is that right? I want to ask three questions today, and the first one we better figure out, what is mercy? The second is, to whom does Jesus expect us to give mercy? And the third is, what's in it for us? So what is mercy? I have a friend who's a pastor who began his ministry in a county seat town in Tennessee in the 1950s. And in that town, really at the very beginning of his ministry, there was a 14-year-old boy from a broken home who was out on his own. And just after Christmas, he stole a car. And then he robbed three stores. And he was not a criminal mastermind at 14. He didn't well cover his crime spree. He was caught pretty quickly, and they threw him in jail, and he appeared before the judge. And kind of reflecting the time period, what happened in the courthouse felt much more like an informal hearing than the trial that it was. Each of the three shopkeepers that he robbed was allowed to speak. The first one came up and was pretty easygoing. He said, "Look, I don't really want to get too involved with this. We've all climbed Fool's Hill. And we've all done things that we regret. And it's Christmas time. And let's just let bygones be bygones. He's 14 years old. Let him go and let's try again." Second shopkeeper came in and was really from the opposite end of the spectrum. He was fighting mad that someone had broken into his store. He didn't have any children, and he didn't know how hard parenting was. And he said, "I say, make him feel pain. Throw the book at him. Do something that'll teach him a lesson." And then the third shopkeeper spoke. She was a retired school teacher and a member of my friend's church, and she asked her young pastor to come along with her. Of the three shopkeepers, she was the poorest and the least able to afford the loss that had come because of the robbery. And she spoke to the boy, not to the judge. She said, "I'm upset because I remember you from an earlier grave, and I'm upset because I don't have to lose what you've taken from me. I can't afford what's happened. But I don't believe that what you did is all that's in your heart. I believe there's more and better stuff in you. I've seen it before, and I believe we could see it again." And then she turned and spoke to the judge. And she said, "I think you're going to have to convict him. He is guilty after all. And then I'd like to ask you to parole him to me. And I'll take him into my own home. And I'll spend a year trying to find that better boy that I know is inside of him and help that better boy get in control so that what happened last night won't ever happen again." It's mercy. Mercy is an expensive virtue because mercy requires from us both a recognition and an engagement. The recognition that mercy requires is that most people, most of the time, are doing the best they can with what they have. And that's an expensive recognition because if you really come to see that that's true, it's not all people all the time, but most people, most of the time, are doing the best they can with what they have. And that means that your parent who failed you, or your friend who betrayed you, or your colleague who blew it, or your spouse who is imperfect, were really doing the best they could with what they have. And it is hard to let go of the anger and the self-righteousness and the superiority and the judgment that comes with saying, "These people have all gotten it wrong." But once you come to see that, then you can see that they're just folks who need help. And that recognition then entails an engagement, because mercy is a creative and generative response to injury. If what you're looking for is justice, justice looks to the past. Justice says, what happened back there and then, and what's the cost to make that right? What's the toll that has to be exacted for that? Justice looks to the past, but mercy looks to the future. Mercy asks, what can yet happen given what has happened? Mercy asks, how can I respond to what is in a way that brings about the best what can yet be? And mercy knows you cannot build a better world with bitter people. Mercy knows that fear is not the pathway of pain, nor the way to redeem a broken world. And that retired school teacher that night showed mercy to that boy. She returned good for evil. And I got to tell you, she did that because she saw not a thief, but a boy. And she was ready to issue a costly involvement of her own life in order to bring a better outcome in that situation. And you need to know that it was reality and not fantasy that drove her decision making. That was honest, not dishonest thinking. It was hopeful, not despairing reasoning. If the future is going to be as important to us as the past, then hope is our only course. If we are more than what we have done, then hope has to be our default setting for life. Mercy is an expensive virtue because it calls from us both a recognition and an engagement. So to whom does Jesus want us to show mercy? To helpless people. Mercy is a way that we use the resource and power that have been entrusted to us to make a difference in the lives of people who have less than we have and who need part of what we have. Do you remember the story of the Good Samaritan in Luke 10? Once upon a time, there was a man going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell into the hands of robbers, and he was beaten and robbed and left for dead by the roadside. Along came a priest and then a Levite, and they saw him there, but they did nothing about his condition. And then along came the last person anybody would think would help, a Samaritan, and he saw him, and he had compassion for him. Luke 10:33, he felt something, and he tended him. Luke 10:34, he did something. He used the resource that was already available to him, what he had on hand, oil and bandages. He put him on his own donkey. He gave of his time. He gave of his money to make a difference in that situation. So according to Jesus, the kind of mercy that we're supposed to exercise in the world involves both feeling and doing. There are some people who think that they have been merciful because they feel things for other people. When they see the plight of other people, they feel bad for them about that. The suffering of other people makes them feel things. And mercy begins in feelings. Do not underestimate the power of feelings. If we don't feel for someone now, we're not likely to issue mercy to them in just a minute. Mercy begins with the urge to break out and to change the way the world works. But if mercy gets no farther than feeling, mercy's going to die. It stops before it ever starts. And that's not the kind of mercy about which Jesus is speaking. John Bright was a Scottish theologian who grew up at the first part of the 20th century, and in his autobiography he recounts growing up on a farm in the Scottish Highlands and walking into town on Saturdays with his farmer father. And one Saturday when he was a boy, he and his dad were coming along the road, and they came to a spot where another fellow from the village where they lived, another farmer, a relatively poor man, was standing. His horse had fallen over and broken its ankle. And all of the people who were gathering realized that the animal was going to have to be put down. There wasn't anything they could do to fix that. And all the neighbors were gathering, and they said to the farmer, "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry about your horse." And John Bright's dad took off his hat, and he got out his wallet, and he took out a note, and he put it inside, and he said, "I'm 5 pounds sorry. How sorry are you?" And he began to pass the hat around the ring of neighbors who'd gathered there. "I'm 5 pounds sorry," says, "I feel for you. And I'm willing to take some of the resource that's been entrusted to me and make a difference in your life, because what happens to you makes a difference to me." That's the kind of mercy we're talking about, the kind of feeling that leads to action. We're supposed to help people who are helpless. But the helpless aren't the only people we're called to issue mercy. Helplessness is frankly the easier category for me. People are routinely helpless through no fault of their own. And even when it is their fault, it makes me feel better to help. I get to get in there and be the fixer. And I like to be the fixer. But in addition to the helpless, Jesus also calls us to issue mercy to the hideous. People who've done terrible or awful things to us or to our children or to our society or its institutions. People who have badly misused the power that's been given to them, and so they have brought hurt rather than help into the world. And showing mercy to the hideous is hard on me because I'm too quick to judge. I want them to get what they deserve. And I'm not alone in that. Our whole society seems to be built on that kind of knee-jerk response. My dad was called to be on a jury in Brazoria County just a few years ago. About 60 people in the jury pool, and they're going through voir dire, and the district attorney who was prosecuting the case asked a question. It became clear this was going to be a criminal case, and the district attorney said, "I want you to imagine that you've been impaneled on the jury, and you have found the defendant guilty." It's good seed planting. "And now we're in the punishment phase of the trial, and you're going to have to choose a punishment for this guilty defendant. And you can only choose the punishment based on one of three criteria, and here they are. Would you choose a punishment that appropriately fits this crime? It balances the scale. That for this action, there was an equal and opposite reaction. Or number two, would you choose a punishment that sends a message out into our society? We do not tolerate this behavior in our community. Everyone who's thinking about doing this particular crime would know I better not do it because here's what might happen to me." Would you, number three, choose a punishment designed to rehabilitate this criminal and bring them back into the fold of society? By show of hands, and they asked, raise your hand if you would choose number one. Raise your hand if you would choose number two. Raise your hand if you would choose number three. There were only three people in a jury pool of 60 who chose number three. And the prosecutor exercised preemptive strikes on all three of them. The mercy that Jesus calls us to issue has to be given to problem people as well. Because the mercy of God involves both giving to those who are in need and forgiving those who have hurt us, the troublemakers of the world. And that's a very different kind of challenge than being a good Samaritan in among needy persons. Mercy is a lovely sentiment until someone hurts you. And then the idea of forgiving that person becomes anathema to us. I had a mentor in college, an Air Force major named Gary Tyler. And Major Tyler used to say, "I trust everybody. Everybody has my complete trust until you lose it. And then you never get it back again." If that's the standard, how do any of us ever make it through? I suspect that forgiving someone who hurts you is the most difficult thing you're ever going to do. You'll never do anything harder in your life. You'll never face a more daunting challenge than letting go of that pain and forgiving someone. Learning how to forgive someone who has hurt you or abused you in some way, who has shamelessly done wrong by you, it is nigh impossible for us in our own power. But if we're going to receive the kind of blessing that Jesus wants to give us, then we have to learn to forgive. Because until we learn to forgive, we can never act out of God's character. We're only reacting out of our pain. We're living out of the past instead of living in the present and into the future. So if we're going to do that, there must be something in it for us. There must be something compelling from Jesus to say, this is why you should go through this difficult exercise. This is why you should take on yourself that kind of pain and bear my kind of image into the world. And here's what it is. On our most honest days, we can confess at least to God and to ourselves, I am helpless. My sin gets the better of me. And I don't have it within me to redeem myself. I don't have a curative power within me that overcomes my sin. So I need a Savior and I need mercy from God. And I have been hideous. I have done terrible things. And I need someone to forgive me and to give me another chance. And I'm asking for God for a large measure of what God is asking me to issue in small measure. And I just don't know how many different ways Jesus can say what he says. Give, and it will be given you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken, will be poured into your lap, for with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Or maybe you like that rendering, forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. Or maybe it's just better to hear it positively. Blessed are those who show mercy, for they shall be shown mercy. Well,